Welcome to the Native Advertising Powerhouse, a podcast dedicated to help publishers and native ad studio professionals build a solid framework for their native advertising efforts. The host of the show is Jesper Lawson, founder of the Native Advertising Institute.
So without further ado, welcome to the 7th episode of the Native Advertising Powerhouse podcast. Today, I have with me Carla Johnson, global keynote speaker, author of 7 books and principal at Type A Communications. We're going to talk about creativity and the collaboration between brands and native ad studios. So welcome on the show, Carla.
Thank you so much, Jesper. I'm delighted to be here.
Good. So you've been working in marketing for more than two decades now. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your experiences?
Absolutely. And I feel like it's a little bit of a winding path that's gotten me to where I am here today. You and I were just chatting a little bit about travel and the paths that life can take you. And that's how I feel my career has been. I'm the youngest of 5 children, and I come from a left brain engineering family. So I first started university as an engineering major, and I'm very right-brained. And after 2 years of studies, I realized enough that that wasn't my natural path. I could have done it, but it would have been pretty painful, I think, for everybody involved, as we see sometimes with things. And I ended up with a master's degree in history, but one of the jobs that I had along the way was working for architecture firms. And that really has been so instrumental and foundational in how I look at everything that I do now as I ended up in marketing. So I did marketing for these architecture firms, but because I didn't have a lot of formal marketing classes or training, I really took on how designers approached the process of creating space and inner workings of space and collaboration in teams. And that's how I came to my approach to marketing.
Okay.
And really looking at, as marketers, what's the experience that we want to create, and then reverse engineering that into the strategy that we have for content.
Wow. And could you elaborate a little on that for those of us who have not been working at that kind of companies?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I think one of the specialties that a firm had that I worked for was children's hospitals. And at the time, the physical spaces for children's hospitals were very cold and intimidating for children. Oftentimes things were very out of scale. So if you're a child and you want to push a button, you know, you see all these pictures of little kids, they're adorable. They're on their tiptoes trying to reach, you know, the elevator button or a door handle or something like that. Mm. But when you're a child and you're sick, it's a very different emotional situation to have everything out of scale, because it gives you a sense that you don't have control over anything. So you go into a hospital where you know you're sick, so you don't have control over that. You are in a physical environment that you don't have control over because you can't reach. There's lots of big scary machines that make noises that you aren't familiar with. Mm. You know, people taking your blood pressure and listening to your heart and looking down your throat. And there's so much that creates feelings of out of control, you know, no control, no familiarity. It's scary. It's frightening. There's so much uncertainty. And so with architects, what they started out with was, what is it that we want the children to feel when they come into a healthcare environment? Mm-hmm. In this situation, they wanted them to feel relaxed, comfortable, familiar. And so these architects started to design these children's hospitals with much more playful interiors. And it started from the time you would drive onto the campus of the hospital. And maybe it was more colorful signage or little playful things, like maybe some butterflies or clowns or something that made the children say, hey, this is something that relates to me, whether they consciously realized it or not. So they looked at, what feeling do we need to create now? What are those elements that will actually create the feeling, you know, from an experience? And then what do we actually need to design to create the experience that evokes the emotion? So the same thing happens in marketing now with when I see really, really successful marketing and native advertising, is that they look at, what is the emotion that we want the reader, the participant to feel? What experience do we need to create to evoke that feeling, and then reverse engineer that? What ads and content do we need to create that actually deliver that experience?
But at the same time, a lot of marketers, you know, be it native advertising or content marketing or other, you know, they still at least say out loud that they have this credo of putting the audience first, you know, be audience centric and all. But do you see a lot of them actually not doing that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think part of that is because, like, in their hearts, they know that's what they want to do. But in their heads, when they sit down to do the work, they don't know how to actually change their behavior to make that happen. So we talk a lot about becoming more customer-centered and audience-centered and things like that. But people don't know, then what do I actually change in my behavior? So when it comes to creativity and some of the things that we do with more innovative thinking and looking at how other situations create that for us, we're not able to relate that back into our day-to-day work. So in a way, I think about, we see this with children when they paint sometimes. They're really good at painting mountains in the background, and then they can paint little stick trees and flowers in the foreground, but there's nothing that bridges the faraway part from the close part, and so it feels really disjointed. And the same thing happens with marketers and the work that they do. They know this far-off part, that we want to be more customer centered, but all we have as something that we can relate to is what's right in front of us, you know, what we see right here. And we don't know how to get from here to there. Mm. And so marketers have the best of intentions. They just don't have the understanding of how to connect the dots to get from where they are now with specifics about the content that they create every day and into a situation where they look at that content from a more customer centered point of view.
But what kind of competencies or even people would you need to bring on board to be able to bridge that gap?
You know, I think one of the main competencies is that we have to flip how we look at this formula. So just like with architects, we have to start out with, you know, what is it that we want people to feel? Where marketers now start out with, what content am I going to create? And they look at how they can force a piece of content into a specific situation for an audience. So even if we look at content from the point of view of what's the bigger story that we're trying to tell, what's the bigger experience that we want to create, and how does this piece of content fit into and contribute to that experience? So a good way to just start this process is to ask yourself, where will people come from before they interact with this piece of content, and where do we want them to go to afterwards? Right. Because that's just a small, minute, and immediate way that people can start to think about, okay, like what actually does happen in the world? And I think the first default that marketers do is that they think that they come from another piece of their brand's content. Mm. But the reality is they could come from a competitor's piece of content, or they could come to this situation from something that's not even really related to what it is that they sell. Mm. And starting to look at all of those paths, those journeys, as we go back to travel, that your customers take and your audience takes can really be eye-opening when we take some time to sit back and look at this bigger picture that's about more than just the content that we create, or, you know, the branded content that we're creating or the platform or things like that.
Mm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I actually think that, you know, we think that publishers, for example, doing traditional journalism are really good at focusing on their audience because they don't have any products to sell in the same way that marketers do. But then I was hired to do a couple of workshops for a big publisher, for all their chief editors, not in the marketing department or anything, just, you know, the editorial chief editors. And at first I said, you know, what could I possibly teach them? They must know everything about creating great content. But I, you know, I accepted the challenge. And as I was sitting down with them, I said, so tell me about your audience. You know, what kind of segments do you have? You know, what are their pain points? And it was, you know, it was very surprising to see how little they actually knew about their audience. They knew a lot about good storytelling. I have to say, a lot of them came from magazine background. They do have online presence, obviously, but they really came from a print background. So it's obviously harder to track and trace, you know, how the audience respond to your content. But still, it was very hard for them to formulate what it really was that resonated with their audience. So even for publishers, even for journalists, this is a very tough task.
You know, I agree. And I do find it interesting because I think journalists are some of the most talented people when it comes to this type of work that we do, because they're so good at telling that story. And I mean, even just the basics of structure and pulling people through content, they're so talented at that. But I think one thing that they haven't had to do is to understand what, you know, let's have a conversation with our audience, not just let's report out. So their background has been the need to create the content in order to push it out for people to read and engage in, but they haven't had to look at how is this piece of content contributing to our overall readership and what it is that people need to know. And they haven't thought about their publication in the form of a brand that represents what specific ideals. So when you take those talents and you transition those into an agency environment or, you know, a corporate environment or something like that, then you start to take those talents, but you have to look at it from the perspective of what is it that we believe that we're using as a platform, you know, a mission statement for what it is that we want to do. And then how do we look at not just pushing out content to audiences, but actually bringing audiences in and being a part of co-creating content. And for some journalists, I think that's really a struggle because it's the purity of reporting on a story from an objective point of view, where they choose, they pick and choose who they talk to and what it is that they pull out and they put in the content. But with this kind of approach, it's much more collaborative and much more inclusive. That's what's really necessary for it to be successful.
Yeah, but that's definitely, that's probably one of the places where marketing or marketers are a little ahead of publishers, because it's not really in the DNA of traditional reporting to have a conversational style. It's more of a one direction communication.
Exactly, because you want to make sure that you aren't influenced so that you can report objectively.
You mentioned before creativity. I'd like to go back to that. A lot of publishers, you know, throughout the world are looking at, you know, with envy to studios like T-Brand Studio from the New York Times or Atlantic Rethink from the Atlantic, studios that create this amazing award-winning native advertising. And they do that, of course, because they're incredibly talented people, but also because they're working with budgets that other publishers, you know, can only dream of. But I know you have a take on creativity. What would you say to those publishers? Should they just, you know, say we're never going to be there, you know, and give up? Or what would you say to those?
You know, and I love this question, Jesper, because I think it's one of the biggest challenges that publishers have is that they look at these brands and the studios like this, and they say, you know, we're publishing on a different topic. We don't have that kind of a budget. We're not that kind of creativity. We don't have the skills of those kind of writers, and we don't have those that level of journalists and things like that. There's always an excuse and a reason to why you should not do that. And I call that brand detachment disorder. And it's something that I realized that I had when I would sit and hear about these amazing brands doing incredible work. And I would think, well, that doesn't relate to me because either I was working in a different industry or a different type of project or something like that. There was always an excuse. And that's where I came up with this term brand attachment disorder, because it's where I see that we tend to start to dismiss how relevant and how applicable great ideas are from another situation, because we think that what we do or sell or how we're structured is very different. And really what we have to do is look at the essence behind what makes them successful and transplant that into our own brand. And I call that a brand transplant. And I think that's the key, because what people tend to do is that they look at things like the New York Times and the Atlantic, and they think they have to copy and paste it into their own situation. And let's face it, there's hardly any other environments or cultures or any other things where that would live and thrive. You know, just like a biology experiment. You know, you couldn't take a cactus from the desert and expect it to thrive in Denmark. It's right. Just a very, very different environment. And the same goes true with ideas and creativity. So if we start to look at what's behind what makes those studios work? Is it because they're highly collaborative? Is it because, back to our audience question, you know, they're better at creating two-directional conversations? Is it, you know, looking at the details of what is it that they're doing, you know, the observing what they're doing, and then finding that essence behind it and then transplanting that essence into other studios? That's how you become successful, rather than trying to copy and paste it.
I know you train a lot of organizations all over the world in this, the art of creativity. Could you share with us some of your thoughts on creativity?
You know, I have a couple that I'm pretty strongly opinionated about. And one is that people think that creativity is just a miraculous talent that you either have or you don't. And I fervently believe that creativity is something that can be taught and learned. And just like any skill, the more you practice it, the better you get at it. And the other is around the idea of innovative thoughts and people who are innovators in their industries or companies or however they work. Mm-hmm. And that's that innovation isn't something that should be a specific responsibility of a small group of people, because generally that even isolates that group if it's an innovation group or a think tank group or something like that. Mm-hmm. That everybody has great ideas. We just have to make sure that people are accountable and responsible for great ideas, because otherwise they say, that's not my job and that's not my responsibility. And they tend to give away a lot of power and a lot of opportunity to really have a great impact, because they think that, you know, I don't have a PhD in something, or I'm not a design thinker, or, you know, I'm not the one who set up the studios. You know, I don't have the accountability or responsibility, when the truth is that everybody has great ideas because their experience and how they interact with the audience or the brand or whatever else it is unique.
How would you hold someone accountable for that other than the creative director?
You know, I look at how many ideas are people bringing to the table. So there's two sides of it. The first is how many ideas are people bringing to the table? And that you can, you know, you can easily count. So how many ideas are being pitched? The other side really falls on creative directors and leaders within an organization, is what kind of feedback are they giving to people who are bringing ideas to the table.
Okay.
That help them evolve those ideas or help them be better at pitching the ideas. So what tends to happen is a team will say, you know what, I bring 100 ideas to my boss all the time, and every time I do, all I ever hear is no. And, you know, the creative directors say, you know, somebody will bring me an idea every once in a while, but it's always, you know, it's total crap. We could never do anything with it. So there's this common ground of people understanding, one, how to transplant the essence behind another experience that they have, you know, whether it's another studio or something as simple as, you know, they went into a coffee shop and they had a great experience. Now, how can you take that essence and transplant it into the work that you're doing in native advertising? And then the other is this idea of the gladiator. And when people come to you as a creative director, do you give them either the thumbs up or thumbs down? Does the idea right. either live or die? Or do you give people feedback in a way that helps them be more courageous in coming forward with ideas and also present ideas in a way that are more helpful? So I look at when people give feedback, I suggest that they give it in two ways. The first is, what is it that you like about the idea? So starting out your feedback with what I like, and then saying some of the things that you like about the idea. Because just the fact that somebody had the courage to come and present an idea
right.
is something that should be rewarded. And then the other aspect of it is to say what I wish. And so this is really important to be super specific about, because many times creative directors will say, well, I kind of like this part, but, you know, take it away and go flush it out a little more and bring it back to me. And they're not specific. And the person who's supposed to flush it out doesn't have a direction to go and actually work on. So really they're just shooting in the dark, or they may say, you know, I don't really know what to do here. And so I'm not going to waste my time because I have, you know, like everybody, we have a ton of stuff on our plate. And so they never come back and try and flesh out that idea. And so creative ideas don't come forward. Innovation doesn't come forward. And that's where everybody tends to be frustrated. So it's really important to look at how are you as a creative director or a leader or an executive in any capacity, how are you giving feedback that's very specific to the people to help them move those ideas forward?
And I know you also, other than having the right feedback and holding people accountable, I know you teach people, you know, how to come up with the creative ideas, a framework for that.
I do. And when I look at the people who are the most innovative people in the world and the most creative, one thing that they are just incredibly natural at is that they observe the world around them and down to the little bitty detail. And I think for us as marketers, this can be hard because we have so much to do and we're always running a million miles a minute that we look at how can we be more efficient. And we tend to put up blinders about just the most simple things in life that's going on around us. But creative people really stop and they notice all the little things that are going on around us. So that's the first step, is just to become much more aware and start to observe the details of something that catches your attention.
Could you try to give us an example of that?
Absolutely. If you start to observe the difference even in coffee shops, and how is it that people go through the queue in the line? How is it that the coffee shops present the different drink menus? How is it that they, you know, bring your coffee to you? Do you pick it up at the end of the counter, or do you do they bring it to you at the table? Do you sit inside? Do you sit outside? Is it cozy and comfy and they encourage you to stay for a long period of time, or is it a quick in and out experience? So just starting to stop and really get down into detail, what is it that you're observing in these situations? And then the second step is to distill those. And when I say distill, what I mean is to start looking for patterns in what you're seeing. Because as humans, our brains are naturally wired to look for patterns. And it can be things such as, in one coffee shop, I notice that they want to anticipate my needs, or they want to wait on me. You know, they want to make sure that this is a luxurious experience. In another coffee shop, the pattern could be, it's all about efficiency. It's all about making sure that you get through the line as quickly as you can and you're out the door to whatever you have to do next. So starting to distill what it is that you've observed to see those patterns. And then this next one, and this, to be honest, this is the hardest part, mm-hmm. is this step from distilling it to relating that back into your brand. So now you can say, when you're looking at native advertising, okay, if we take the example of the idea of luxuriating in an experience, okay, right. How do we start to make our readers feel like our content is luxurious? How do we make them want to spend more time with it? How do we want to give them the impression that it's higher end? You know, maybe it's content placement. Maybe it's things such as the look and feel. Maybe it's what happens after they go to that ad. So what is it about the total experience? Back to what's the feeling that we want to create? Now, what are the things that create that experience? And then we look at, okay, now what ideas do we generate? And then you pitch those to the creative director. Because what happens in most situations is that we say, okay, we need new ideas for a campaign that's coming up. You know, let's go do a brainstorm. And people just start throwing out ideas. But what those teams do is that they get caught in this cycle of generating and pitching ideas, you know, whether it's to creative directors or it's to clients, mm-hmm. however it is. And there's never an infusion of truly unique ideas, but it's the teams that use the time to take advantage of these first three steps, to observe the world around them, distill the patterns that they're seeing, and then relate that into their brand before they look to generate ideas. They're the ones who are really bringing about these fresh ideas. Mm.
So step number one is notice experiences everywhere you go. So open up your eyes.
Right, really observe the world around you.
And the second one is distill what you see.
Mm-hmm. Into patterns, yeah.
And then the third one is relating what you distill back to your brand or to whatever it is that you're doing.
Exactly. And then look at how you generate ideas and pitch them.
Okay, that's a nice process.
Thank you.
So a native advertising project is per definition a campaign that runs for a certain amount of time, as with a traditional ad campaign, by the way. And that kind of limits the value that a brand can derive from the investment. And the investment can sometimes be very substantial. So a way to expand the value would be to integrate this project into the other marketing activities that a brand is doing. You know, it could be the content marketing activities or others. Now, the challenge for most studios is that they're made of with editorial people, you know, with little or no marketing experience. And as I mentioned at the beginning, you have 2 decades of experience with marketing. Do you think that publishers should step up to the challenge? And if so, what would your advice be?
Absolutely, because I think this is a point that publishers aren't understanding that greatly affects their success going forward. Because as we look at brands in general and audiences looking for more story-driven experiences, that ability to understand even a story strategy that goes beyond their native campaign is critical, because you can absolutely tell a story through a native advertising campaign that still greatly complements and contributes to the bigger story. And we see that with brands like Land Rover and what they did with, you know, some of their work. Mm-hmm. It absolutely feeds into other things that they've done, and it is unique and what they've done really, really well, because I went to dig into some of the videos that they did, and I ended up being on YouTube for hours. It was a looking at Land Rover video. They did a great job of looking at where do people come before they look at this content, and where can we send them to afterwards. Mm. So, you know, part of looking at what that strategy is and how to make it more than just a campaign is, where do you want to send them next? Mm. You know, that actually gives a lot more value to the campaign, because then it doesn't end at that specific time, and then you continue to get value out of it long after that paid portion is done.
But I think that a lot of publishers might be a little hesitant. You know, they're all, you know, almost all of them struggling financially. Mm-hmm. And if they were to, you know, send people elsewhere, I mean, a lot of them do integrate, say, Facebook into their campaigns to get more reach or so. But as soon as they start driving people away from their own platforms, they're worried that, you know, that's when they stop making any money. So
I think one thing you have to consider is, what is it that your customer ultimately wants? Mm. And what is it that will drive value and ultimately revenue for them? Because that's when people will come back. If the source of the revenue is the native ad campaign, mm-hmm. then brands will want to do more native ad. And that's what we have to look at.
There's, as more and more native ad campaigns are running, there is a focus on renewal of those projects for publishers, obviously. And a lot of them are seeing very poor results in that respect, meaning the percentage of brands are actually renewing their campaigns. And that probably ties into the value or the lack of value that you're able to provide and prove to those brands that might expand beyond just the actual campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of this is also, if we look at how you build a stronger relationship between a publisher and a client, mm-hmm. it's understanding that the work that you do as a publisher isn't a one-off, that you're a core part of a bigger strategy. And so you have to look at how can you integrate with that? Because if you are a standalone and you seem that you're a tangent off to the side, you know, sometimes it's easier to make that cut and not to renew, because they see it as something that isn't part of a whole. Mm. So that makes it easier to say, okay, here's one part specifically that we can carve off and not take away from our budget. That may be a part of looking at the value of the renewal.
But even if you believe, and I agree with you, that publishers could and should be a core part of the overall strategy, some publishers might face trouble convincing brands to let them in on the bigger idea, on the bigger strategy. What would you advise them to do? What argument should they give to the brand so that they can become part of this core team?
You know, and it goes back to studios having teams that are made up of editorial people mm-hmm. without marketing experience. So I think the first is just understand your client's world, you know, and that's true of any business in any industry, is that you really have to understand what matters to your customer and to understand how to build audiences. So publishers, that's what they have always thrived off of, is the ability to build an audience, which drives revenue from other perspectives. So the same is true with their ability to help their clients build the audience, because they do have that amazing talent. It's their ability to relate it and bring it in and show their clients how to do the same. Because in that way, it's not just a tactical role that they have, it's a strategic partnership that they can develop.
Yeah. And it gives them the ability to integrate KPIs that are not only traffics or page views or some of those that some might call vanity metrics that are important, obviously, for the end goal. But if that's mm-hmm. the only thing you can report on, it might be difficult to prove the value to a client. Whereas if you could integrate some of the KPIs that are maybe not on your own platform, then you would be able to show more value.
You can show contribution to things. And that's really true, because if you are a studio and you understand the bigger picture of what your client wants to accomplish, like from a business objective, you may have more ideas and things that you could suggest to your client that would help them accomplish those, that if you weren't a part of that bigger picture or weren't asking the questions or weren't coming to the table with opportunities for other strategic approaches, you wouldn't know. So it's an opportunity to look at the work that you do, not from a tactical and executional point of view, but back to that strategic partner. Because any company who has a partner who can help them accomplish their business objectives, especially as they can show their role in contributing or generating revenue, that's a gold mine. That's a partner people don't want to let go of.
Let's flip it around for a second and look at it from a brand perspective. If you were representing a brand, what would you be looking for when choosing a studio partner?
I think one is their background and track record. And that doesn't have to mean with the studio. If it's a new studio, it's looking at the people who have created the content. Mm-hmm. What is their point of view about, you know, especially audience creation? And even though you may be doing campaigns, how does that contribute to the bigger story? How can you start to see the ability to create consistency in the work that you do? So what are those threads of continuity that go throughout campaigns and show that they can contribute to something bigger? Because anytime you do campaigns, you start and stop. What you do is you probably just start to get your audience interested, and then you stop and you move on to something else. Mm. So even though, you know, they may have a beginning and an end, looking for some way to bring that thread of familiarity, the thread of a story, the thread of an idea forward in each time so that things don't perpetually feel new and unfamiliar to people. Because when we're looking at something new and unfamiliar, then our minds have to go, wait a minute, okay, how does this fit into what that brand stands for? You know, how does this all work together? How does this benefit me? And we have to look at that familiarity aspect of it and continuity.
Mm. You've been in the content space for years now. You've seen brands working with all kinds of agencies. What does it take in general to get a good collaboration between a brand and an agency going?
I think the biggest thing that it takes that we don't invest in is just really, really great communication. And I think sometimes because we're in this marketing and communication space, we assume that's the case, but that's actually the thing that I think that we can sometimes be the worst at, because we take it for advantage. We assume that what we're talking about, other people understand, and vice versa. You know, brands are assuming that publishers just know what they want, and publishers are assuming that brands understand their process and how it works and what can be done. And that, you know, the number of times, Jesper, that I've heard people say, well, if that's what they wanted, why didn't they just ask for it? You know, when they move on to somebody else, or if they say, we're not going to renew this, or and it's clearly because there's been a lack of communication or a breakdown in communication. And it is time consuming, but that's the payoff of it, is that it's a stronger relationship and it feels more like a partnership rather than a handoff of some things to be tactically executed.
And I guess that holds even more true when you're trying to make two parties work together that hasn't historically been working together. I mean, one thing is a marketing agency, a brand. You know, that's been going on for years now. But a publisher as a studio and a brand, they're not used to working together.
Exactly. And so you have people who are working in a new type of capacity for the work and with a new type of client. So that's two really, really big different things. And then brands coming to them in ways they haven't traditionally worked together. So there is a lot of assumptions and I think stereotype thinking that the studios who really take the time to learn about what their client needs and brands in general are going to be the ones that really come out ahead.
Do you have any practical advice on how to get this communication going, both, you know, from the brand and from the studio?
You know, part of it is looking, do you practice what you preach? And I think for content producers and native advertisers and publishers, are you actually doing what you say needs to be done yourself so that you can turn around and prove how well it works in your situation? Because there's many times where I see publishers giving people advice on how things should be done, but they're not practicing that themselves so that they really understand the ins and outs of how it works and the dynamics. Because I think unless you can speak from personal experience with some of these things, it won't have as much credibility.
Mm. And what does a brand need to do to to make sure that they communicate what they need and what they want to a publisher?
One of the biggest things, and I think brands are a little bit aloof about this, is bringing their partners closer to them and being more open about what their priorities are, what their objectives are as a team, whether or not it involves directly the publisher. Because the more the publisher can understand the bigger picture mm-hmm. of what they're trying to accomplish, the more valuable that they'll be. But marketers and brands are historically bad at sharing that information. They don't create a collaborative relationship, and that's really what I think brands need to look at doing.
But why are they hesitant to sharing that? Because it seems, when you say it, it seems obvious.
I think part of it is that, to be honest, it just doesn't occur to them. They don't think of the relationship in that way. They think of it as a tactical handoff, and they don't think of it as in, you know, I really need to ask the publishers, you know, let's look at their expertise. Let's ask them about what has worked before. Mm. It's just not being aware on their end. And also probably thinking they know better for their brand. And I'm not taking advantage of the expertise that publishers can really bring.
And I think probably on the publisher's side, you need to be not afraid of asking the so-called stupid questions. You need to be able to sit down and say, listen, I didn't get it. I really need to understand what it is that you want, you know, that you're looking for.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, when somebody says we need something with more creativity, well, let's really define what creativity means to both sides. Yeah. Because creativity for a brand may mean we'll use a light blue font instead of a dark blue font. And creativity for the publishers could mean something really new and unique. You know, so it's defining things and taking out assumptions mm-hmm. as much as possible. So some brands may just assume that's not the role that publishers have. And some publishers may just assume that the brands won't share information with them. But I think that ability to collaborate and share information from a much bigger picture than just the native advertising part is really important for the relationship to be successful.
Let's dive into the content itself. You know, obviously publishers are excellent at creating editorial content that resonates with their audience. If they're still in business, but they're much less experienced in creating branded content. What is good content, good branded content to you?
To me, good branded content is always content that delivers value. First and foremost, that's what it has to be. Because unless it's delivering value, there's no reason for people to continue to come back.
But you could say that about the editorial content as well, but you know, you somehow need to infuse the brand, not necessarily in the story itself, but you know, to give the brand the commercial value of it, you need to somehow have them involved. How do you do that without jeopardizing the value that you bring to the audience?
Well, I think it's fine to say that the content is brought by a brand. It's fine to be perfectly clear that it's branded content. But what happens with most branded content is that it's really just a big push and sales job for the brand. It's not truly delivering value. So if you go back to that formula about when an audience interacts with branded content, what is it that you want them to feel? Do you want them to feel educated? Do you want them to feel inspired? Do you want them to feel entertained? You know, those kind of things. And then you start to look at, okay, well, if that's the case, then what experience do we have to create that does that? And then we reverse engineer it. So it's fine to have the brand front and center as long as you're accomplishing what matters most to your audience, because we see many brands being successful with branded content like that.
You've also been working in the content marketing space for a long time. And for those of the listeners who are a little confused, you might say that content marketing has owned media at the center. You know, it can live on other platforms as well, but it does have owned media as a very strong, probably the most important, strongest component in the program, whereas native advertising takes place on somebody else's platform. But if you were running a content marketing program for a brand with an owned media as a centerpiece, how would you use native advertising in that?
I would use it to build the breadth and depth of my audience, because not even with your owned media property, it doesn't mean that everybody knows that you're out there. So one of the keys is to go to where your audience is already. And that's what's so important and why native advertising is helpful, is because there will be many publishers who already have an audience that matters to you and they don't even know you exist. Yeah. And so that has to be a part of the plan.
So kind of a rent-to-own strategy. You rent the eyeballs of a publisher to drive them to your own platform?
Exactly. And also the credibility of the publisher. Being a part of a strategic partnership like that means that people will look at you and say, okay, well, I now trust you because I first read your content on this publisher's site. And I know that I trust this publisher. And I know that I consistently go to this publisher to find other information from, you know, on other topics that matter to me as a professional or me as somebody looking to keep ahead of my industry and things like that. So it does a great deal to add credibility to who
and
you are.
And I think other than adding that and the numbers to your audience, you know, for many content marketers, it's still kind of no-go to buy reach because at least a couple of years back, the credo was if you build it, they will come. So if you publish... If your content is good enough, people will find it eventually. And so going out and buying the reach kind of seems like not the right thing to do. But what it does allow you to do, though, is target a specific niche audience or an audience in a more structured and scalable way, as opposed to just waiting for, you know, the viral wings of social or the spiders of Google to people find your content.
Absolutely, because, you know, even with blockbuster movies, Hollywood movies, they still invest in making sure people know that their content is there. Yeah. You know, so it's the same is true for every brand. And native advertising is a way to get in front of that audience. Like you said, the other methods may work, but it takes a long time for that to build. And sometimes your job may not be available for that long if you can't ROI, you know, sooner than that. So it's an amazing opportunity to help jumpstart that and to, you know, to really test some content as well and see what.
So you got to market your marketing.
Exactly, you do. Exactly.
Let's finish off with a crystal ball question. So where do you see the native advertising industry going in the next couple of years?
You know, I think a big place that I see it going is a little bit about what we've talked about, Jesper, is a stronger collaboration between the publishers and the brand. And maybe that's hopeful thinking there. But I think for it to really be successful and for it to scale is that there has to be a stronger partnership between both parties.
And finally, other than preparing for your presentation for Native Advertising Days in Berlin in November, what are you working on these days?
I'm working on my next book. It would be my eighth book, and it's all about the idea of rethinking innovation and where ideas come from. Because back to that idea that we think only a special few people, either with the job title or natural born talents, are the ones who come up with great ideas. There's actually a process behind the great ideas, and the most creative people, the most innovative people all follow the process, whether they realize it or not.
And who would be the audience for that book?
This is really anybody who wants to be better at bringing great ideas into an organization. So whether it's you want to have better ideas to bring in, or you want the process to bring in ideas to be much smoother and efficient and effective as far as pitching ideas, or someone who wants to make sure that their team is much more innovative and creative and they get more power out of them in that way. So traditionally, this has been something that really, really resonates with people at the executive level because they want a better performance. And they're saying either I want to understand this better or I need my team to understand this. And that's where a lot of the training that I do comes in.
I'd say that applies to our audience on this podcast as well. Do you have a name for the book yet?
It's Rethink Innovation.
Rethink Innovation. And when can we buy the book?
It looks like it will be probably second quarter 2019. It depends on how fast I get writing.
That's good. We'll be looking forward to that, Carla. And we'll also be looking forward to seeing your presentation at Native Advertising Days. And thank you so much for taking your time out to share some of your thoughts and experiences with our listeners.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much,
okay.
Jesper.
Thank you, Carla. And for our listeners, if you like what you've heard, please drop us a review on iTunes or SoundCloud. And while you're there, make sure you subscribe. We are also now available on Podcast and Stitcher. But whatever platform you prefer for listening, remember that you can also be notified each time we launch a new episode by signing up for our podcast newsletter at nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/podcast. And finally, If you want to learn more, please join us in Berlin for Native Advertising Days, November 6th through 8th. It's closing up. So visit nativeadvertisinginstitute.com/days for more information. That's all for now, folks. Next time, we'll have Juliane Südow, who is the director at Axel Springer Brand Studio from Germany, joining us on the podcast. So make sure to be back for more insights on how to build a native advertising powerhouse.
That's it, you guys. Remember to subscribe to the Native Advertising Powerhouse podcast on iTunes or SoundCloud.